8:30, we're going to get the meeting about state government finance and elections started for today, January 29th, 2021. Under House Rule 10.01, we're holding this meeting remotely, and the committee assistant will take the role.
Chair Nelson?
Here.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Here.
Representative Nash?
Present.
Representative Bonner?
Present.
Representative Drazkowski?
Drazkowski here.
Representative Elkins?
Here.
Representative Greenman?
Present.
Representative Cleborn?
Present.
Representative Kosnick? Representative Mason?
Present.
Representative New Brindley?
Present.
Representative Pulowski?
Present.
Representative Quam?
Present.
A quorum is present.
Thank you, Ms. Breck. Now we're going to go back to the House File 9, and I'll move to take it. We just laid this over so I can take it off the table without we didn't take a motion to do that. Start off, before we get back to the questions, I'm going to have our House researcher, Matt Gehring, walk us through this quickly, and then we'll get back to questions. And I'll start with where we ended up yesterday with New Brindley. I think she had a few more questions, and then we'll go down the list that I have from yesterday. Mr. Gehring, if you want to walk us through the bill.
And members, so I'm not going to walk through section by section in the bill because there's so many sections, but what I'll do is just highlight the policy components that make up each article of the bill. And I'm happy to point members to specific questions or specific sections or lines if they have questions about individual items.
That'd be great.
So Article 1, we'll start there, is an article that relates primarily to voter registration policy changes. The sections to highlight in Article 1 would be Section 2. This is a new section that requires post-secondary institutions to provide housing lists of students residing in institutional housing, as well as students residing within 10 miles of campus as a condition of receiving state grant funding. Also in Article 1 is Section 3, which is a substantive section that allows individuals who are age 16 or 17 to pre-register to vote before they turn age 18. Section 5 in Article 1 is a section that requires the Secretary of State or authorizes the Secretary of State to provide features on the online voter registration platform that allows third parties to connect to the online registration system and facilitate registration with people who are interacting with that third party. So it's effectively like you could set up an app or some other feature like that that would facilitate registration. On page 6, there's a new, so there's a series of sections in Article 1 that codify existing administrative rules related to proofs of residence on Election Day. There's one new policy component within those sections, and that relates to tribal registration by members of tribes. So on page 6, line 6.23, you'll see a new paragraph there that allows individuals who live on reservations to use the address of the tribal headquarters or another designated address as their residential address for registration purposes, and that would be used in the event that they otherwise live at a residence that doesn't at an address that isn't recognized by the U.S. Postal Service. And then finally, in Article 1, Section 12 is a fairly substantial section that creates a system of automatic voter registration in Minnesota and provides, there's a number of details in there, but that provides that individuals applying for a driver's license or state ID card or learner's permit, as well as individuals applying for medical assistance from Minnesota Care and then in some other agency situations where there is a proof of citizenship accompanying an application for benefits or services, those people would be automatically registered to vote. And there's details in there about how a person could decline that registration or other procedures that would happen to verify the person's eligibility. And Mr. Chair, those are the policy items in Article 1. Article 2 is an article that has the most policy components, and there's a variety of different types of provisions there that relate to the right to vote and access to a ballot. So Section 1 is the substantive section that restores the right to vote for individuals who have been convicted of a felony. Section 8 of Article 2 provides for, it amends the existing law that provides a permanent absentee ballot application to interested individuals and instead would provide them a permanent absentee ballot delivery. So instead of applying, they get, automatically get an application every election cycle, they would get an actual ballot every election cycle. On page 20, page 22, section 12 is language that amends this, the witness requirement for absentee voters. So this eliminates the need for a witness signature on an absentee ballot unless the voter has already, or the voter is not already registered. So there would still need to be a witness signature. If the voter is registering for the first time and needs to show proof of residence and identity as part of their absentee ballot. And that section in the bill itself looks like the entire signature requirement is going away, but the amendment that Representative Greenman proposed yesterday changed it to require that witness signature for registration purposes. And section 14 on page 24, there are new deadlines for the receipt of absentee ballots. This is a section that came up in some questions yesterday. So now absentee ballots can be counted if they're received in person by 8 p.m. on election day or if they're postmarked on election day and are received within 7 days of election day. There's a definition of postmark included there. Section 16 and page 24 is a new policy provision that requires the establishment of absentee ballot drop boxes at different locations within a county. Section 17 and page 26 is a section that requires absentee ballot instructions to be printed in languages other than English. The required languages here would be Spanish, Hmong, and Somali. Section 18 on page 26 is a new section that that requires the Secretary of State to provide information on absentee ballot rejections and the reasons for the rejections at an aggregate level. So you're not finding out individual voters' reasons for rejections, but overall the reasons why ballots are being rejected during an election cycle. And then there's a series of sections in Article 2 here, starting with Section 25, substantively that establishes a new structure of early voting in Minnesota that would replace the existing in-person absentee ballot process that uses a drop box instead. There'd be a more formal early voting system in Minnesota. Section 33, which is on page 34 of the bill, strikes existing language that limits the number of voters a person can assist in the polling place on election day to 3, so that language is eliminated, and that section goes along with some litigation we saw last summer over that issue in courts. And that's all of Article 2, and then I'll move to Article 3. Article 3 is a voter intimidation section as well as a HABA section. Section 1 of Article 3, which is on page 38, provides a statutory appropriation of Help America Vote Act funds to the Secretary of State for purposes that are authorized in that federal law. So under current law, those funds are only available to the Secretary if it's specifically appropriated by further legislation, and we saw that happen a couple times in the last 2 years. This would just make it an automatic transfer to the Secretary of State without the need for additional legislative action. And then I'll highlight Section 3 in this article is a substantive section that provides new remedies for voter intimidation, interference, and deceptive practices. There are both civil remedies as well as criminal penalties for violation of those sections. And there's a definition of intimidation and some other things in there that apply with a good amount of detail. So you might take a look at the specifics there, and I'm happy to answer questions if you have them. Then, Mr. Chair, that's all the election administration policy, and then the next couple of articles are campaign finance related, so I'll move to Article 4, which starts on page 40 of the bill. First section I'll highlight in Article 4 is on page 42. Section 5 creates a new regulated entity referred to as a small donor political committee and fund. And a small donor political committee fund has some specific limitations on the types of contributions they can accept and the expenditures that they can make. The couple things to highlight here, one is that they will be permitted to engage in coordinated expenditures with candidates and political parties, as well as with other committees and funds. And they're also able to assist in the Democracy Dollar program that I'll talk about in just a second. On page 45, section 8 is a new exemption that relates to the spending limits that apply to candidates in a campaign. This would exempt certain, or referred to here as grassroots expenditures. So these are expenditures that a campaign has for staff, and also for direct voter contacts. So those expenditures on a campaign report would not be counted against the candidate's expenditure limit during the election cycle. And then on page 46, section 11, you'll see there's a new small donor match program. So this program would provide a state matching funds for contributions that a candidate or political party receives from a small donor, and there's a limitation on how big the contribution can be. For candidates for office, the state match would provide a 6x match for contributions that come from the candidate's district. For contributions that don't come from the candidate's district but come from somewhere else in Minnesota, the candidate would receive a 3x match of that contribution from state funds. Then a political party would be entitled to an equal match of the contribution for contributions that they receive. Then I'll move ahead to page 50, starting on section 16, and there's a series of sections that follow here that establish what's called here a democracy dollar coupon program. So the way this program would work is that every registered voter in Minnesota would get two $25 coupons in the mail sent from the Secretary of State's office that they would then be able to assign to a specific candidate or party of their choice. And then the candidate or party would be able to redeem that coupon through the campaign finance board for a $25 contribution to their campaign fund. So there are eligibility requirements. I won't go through the details here, but you can see them in the bill that set out which types of candidates qualify for the Democracy Dollar Coupon Program, as well as which parties qualify. In general, for candidates, candidates would need to agree to abide by the spending limits that are provided in current law. And at the end of Article 4, Section 30, this is on page 57, repeals two programs that are effectively being replaced by the items I just talked about. It repeals the PCR political contribution refund program, as well as the public subsidy program structure. It doesn't eliminate the tax checkoff that you all see on the income tax and property tax refund forms, but it does repeal the mechanism of providing public subsidy contributions to candidates in the existing law. And Article 5 on page 58 has a couple of disclosure-related provisions. First, in Section 1, which is on page 58, expands the definition of express advocacy. And this definition is used to determine whether an independent expenditure is required to be reported as a campaign expenditure under campaign finance law. And then Section 2 on page 58 expands the required disclaimer for independent expenditures to require that the top three contributors to that expenditure be disclosed as part of the disclaimer. And then Section 4 on page 59 requires the campaign finance board to adopt rules that regulate the disclaimer required on electronic communication, such as banner ads and other small items that appear electronically online or in other places. And then finally, Mr. Chair, the last Article 6, contains two sections. Section 1 on page 60 lists redistricting principles that must be used for creating congressional legislative districts. And then Section 2 of Article 6 is a series of provisions that regulate the legislative process that applies to the way that districts are adopted and approved. And, Mr. Chair, that's the entirety of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. If not, I'll go back to questions here. Now, Representative New Brindley, you were asking questions, and it sounded like you had a couple more questions at the. So if you go ahead and ask your questions.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. And I also I really appreciate you bringing this bill back this morning. I mean, clearly it's a big bill and one that we needed more time for. So I really appreciate your consideration in that, Mr. Chair. And I will just move on. I was working through the bill and I've got some additional questions and I appreciate the time. And I will just move to my next question, my list. On page 38 of the bill, Article 3, it discusses the standing appropriation for the HAVA money, for the federal HAVA money. Is Secretary of State Simon on again this morning? Excellent. Mr. Chair, if I could ask the Secretary of State, has that HAVA money typically requires state matching funds? Is that correct?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative New Brindley, yeah, that's typically been the way it goes. Yes, correct.
Mr. Chair.
New Brindley.
So then can I just ask, Mr. Secretary, what happens then if this standing appropriation comes to you, you spend that money, and then you do not receive those state matching funds, that money is not appropriate. What happens then with that money that has been spent?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative New Brindley, yeah, I mean, you're right to isolate that. That is always a risk of any secretary, which is if you don't come up with a match in a specified period of time, it's typically, I can't remember, 2 years or something like that. If you don't come up with it, then potentially, I don't know that it's ever happened, but potentially that money could be clawed back by the federal government.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Secretary Simon. And of course, we did hear this bill in committee last year as well. That's always problematic, you know. I mean, if we're doing a standing appropriation that requires a state match, we're not doing a standing state match with this, which is also the right thing to do, to not do a standing right. appropriation for that. But that's a real concern, because of course then that money either has to be found by the Secretary of State's office, or they have to come back to the legislature. And as we know, the Secretary of State's office has already asked for an additional $1 million to their budget this year. I'm guessing that they would have a difficult time finding that money in their own budget to claw that back. So I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. The next question I have is regarding the small donor match program. On page 47, I guess, you know, let's do it this way. So I would to Representative Greenman, this is called the Small Donor Match Program. However, and please let me know if I'm reading this wrong, but the way I read this is that a donor can make a small contribution that then can be matched 6 times. That contribution from the state portion will be 6 times that, but then that donor can still go back and max out to a campaign later. Is that correct? Am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question, Representative New Brindley. The way it works is that you will only be able to go back later once you have maxed out the total public funds. And so the goal is if you give, and I may phone a friend in a second, I have senior counsel Demos Adam Liaz, who's been working on these programs. But so you can only give up to $100 and it will be matched. And the candidate, there at some point, there will be a maximum amount of public funds. And so you can only go back to that donor if you have maxed out on your total public funds. Let me, just to make sure that I gave you the right answer, let me see if Adam Liaz can, Mr. Chair, can I ask Adam Liaz to help me out with this question?
Adam Liaz, if you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. My name is Adam Liaz. I'm a senior counsel with DEMOS, which is a national public policy organization that works on money and politics, voting rights, and racial equity and economic opportunity. And I've been working on public financing as well as other money and politics issues for a number of years. So, and Representative Greenman is correct. The concept here is that the intention is to allow representatives to run their campaigns focused on small dollar donors and to have the match be focused on that. At the same time, we understood when Representative Greenman was crafting the legislation, she understood that there would be a limit on the number, amount of match that would be available for fiscal reasons to candidates. And so we do not, one of the important things about crafting these systems is providing the incentives so that the maximum participation is feasible and candidates choose to participate. And we did not, Representative Greenman did not want to create a system by which candidates could opt into the system and then have a not be able to get sufficient public funds and then be stuck and not be able to go back to their core donor base. So the concept is to help candidates build that core donor base within their districts and then be able to go back to those core donors if and only if the public funds run out.
Thank you, Mr. Leos. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
A couple more questions. I want to move on, give other people a chance to ask questions also. So two more questions.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, but please remember this is a 64-page bill. There are a lot of questions to be asked.
Representative New Brindley, I understand that, but we have other people that are on the list from yesterday, and new people, and so we can get back to you, but I want to make sure we're fair and let everybody have a chance to ask. So two more questions, and then we'll go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would also just point out that I'm not asking gotcha questions. I'm not being political. These are reasonable questions to ask. So I would hope that you would give a little leniency in making sure that they are.
I understand that. And I have been very lenient. And just like I said, two more questions and then we'll move on and we can get back to you when and if we have time.
So Representative Greenman, my concern with this section is certainly in my district, I think like a $500 donation, that's a big donation from my constituent. My concern with this small dollar match program is that this actually incentivizes those donors who could give more to give less. Because if I have a $500 contribution, that's what I get from them. However, if I get a $100 contribution, that actually becomes $700. And so there's an incentivization here to shift this financing of campaigns from individual donors to the state. And that's a real concern for me with that provision. Now, I understand that if in the event that they max out those donors, then that donor could come back and give more. But the math is just such that it incentivizes actually giving a smaller donation and letting the state pick that up. My next question is...
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to sort of answer to that question, Mr. Chair.
Okay, go ahead, Representative Greenman.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Brindley. I really appreciate digging in because I do think that this is an area where we need to make sure that the policy both matches what it takes to create grassroots campaigns where every one of your donor, every folks in your district can participate, and also that it works for campaigns, right? The work that everybody is doing, that all of us did on our campaigns is out there engaging voters and talking to people and making your case about why you should represent them. What I will say is I actually think that the bigger interest here is folks who don't have $500, folks who have $10 or $50 or $100. And matching it actually means that for you as a candidate or me as a candidate, if I'm going out and I'm talking to somebody who has $10 in their pocket, it is worth it to both have that conversation, but also if they want to support me, they can give me $10 and it'll be $60, which is a bigger donation. So I think working through all these issues are really important, but I do think thinking about those smaller donors who right now are not engaged is a big piece of where this policy ends up. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative New Brindley, your next question.
Thank you, Madam or Mr. Chair. And that was not a question. So, my next question is on page 50, the Democracy Dollars Program. I don't see an appropriation for the Secretary of State in the bill. Is there an appropriation for the Secretary of State? It looks like the fiscal note indicates that this will come at a cost of $3 million to the Secretary of State's office.
Representative Greenman.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative New Brindley. There will actually be an amendment with that appropriation. We didn't get that until a conversation yesterday, and it was too late for the amendment deadline today. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Brindley, just so you know, everyone knows, there was an amendment that was prepared by Mr. Gehring and with consultation with Ms. Roberts about that. Because it came late, I did speak with Representative Nash last night. We decided to wait till later to put that on and not do it today because it missed the deadline. So there is an amendment out there, and Representative Nash has seen it. So that is that would take care of the money part of that. So Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this will be my final question then. So, Mr. Chair, I appreciate I appreciate the time and I appreciate the candor, Representative Greenman. It's been really helpful. Let me just say my biggest concern with this bill, and I promise this comes with a question, my biggest concern is that this comes in this next biennium with a $36 million price tag. And in the tails, it's almost $40 million per biennium. And that's even with exchanging the current program for a new program. So it's getting rid of the PCR. That accounts for the fact that we're getting rid of the PCR program. We are increasing the cost to $36 million. And frankly, this is a shift to politicians. That's embarrassing. This is literally welfare for politicians. It's bonkers. And it's especially concerning at a time when right now we're facing a deficit. You know, and Governor Dayton came out with his budget. I don't know that any of these items were in his budget, or Governor Walz came out with his budget. I don't know that any of these items were in his budget, but you know, he certainly had tax increases on corporations and the wealthy. And I think it's important to note that Governor Dayton's Department of Revenue actually said that those taxes are predominantly paid by consumers through higher prices and employees through lower wages. Those taxes are not borne by the corporations. They are borne by those who are paying for goods and services, which includes all Minnesotans. And it's borne by employees, often those low wage earners, through lower wages. The other option is making cuts to government in other places. We know that 40% of our budget is in education. The next largest portion is in HHS. So I have real concerns, obviously, about cutting substantially to come up with this $36 million. So I guess my question is, what is your vision for paying for this bill?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative New Brindley. And I think I share the value that what we do here is really think about what Minnesotans need, what their interests and values are, and how we usher and steward our collective resources. I will say at a moment where in this two-hour hearing, Elon Musk will have made $36 million and Bezos in the next 4 hours will have made $36 million. The $36 million feels like a pretty small cost to pay for the basic infrastructure of our democracy. And I will also note, just in terms of digging into the fiscal note, that the majority of these costs are actually going to voters, to the available to the 3.3 million voters. To decide who to support, whoever they choose, of all major parties, and like we have the PCR now, folks of all major parties, all candidates who are participating, 85%, I think it was in 2020. And so I actually think that in this moment, both with the sort of urgent and the undone work, investing in our democracy and doing it in a way that raises progressive revenue and really looks at who in our who is benefiting right now, and who in our who and what entities are can afford it, and also who is going to make the decisions here at the Capitol. The voices of our democracy are really important. And so I really appreciate the question. And I also think that these are really important investments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative New. The next person on my list is Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have some comments and a couple of questions. But I'll try to keep it a little bit more concise if I can. So the first thing I wanted to just discuss is I want to thank Representative Greenman for bringing the bill forward. We've somehow lost a little bit yesterday in our discussion and maybe even a little bit today. We've lost the fact that voters are at the heart of voting. These are our constituents. These are the folks that we answer to every day. And we have to remember that it's our job to put people first, right? To make sure that government works for real people. That's our job. I mean, that's why they hire us, literally, every 2 years. And so I think that the one thing I appreciate about this bill, the Democracy for the People Act, is that there are a lot of measures in this bill that are very forward-thinking, but very common sense at the same time. And really talking about how we get some of that big money out of our system, how we focus on grassroots and individual voters. You know, I think it's a great idea to have candidates have to work for that match, right? To go after the donor that can only give $10 versus the one that can afford to give $500 or $1,000. You know, all of those individuals are a part of our system and they should have equal weight. And as elected officials, I think it's important for us to make sure that we're focusing on each and every voter, not just picking and choosing the ones who are wealthy enough to donate to our campaigns. So I think that's really good. I also wanted to say briefly, yesterday we talked with Representative Dabney about his bill and using medical bills. Again, this is about making government work for real people. You know, we know the realities of a modern government, and some of the traditional items that we have are not available to use as identification. That doesn't mean you're only allowed to use a medical bill, right? We have to have more than one piece of information and documentation. And so meeting people where they are, if it has all the required elements, just makes good sense. And I think we need to keep that in mind when we talk about this. Not to mention, I think we want to encourage our students to get out and participate in voting, which we know is always a challenge to get those folks out there and voting. So I really appreciate that. For Representative Greenman, I just want to say, you know, this bill, I appreciate that we have campaign finance reform in here, which we know is long, long overdue, decades overdue. It takes some of the money out of politics. It puts us back into the grassroots and putting people before corporations. It has greater transparency. It has more information and transparency about who's trying to influence our vote. And we've seen the numbers, and I've dug into a number of studies of both Democrats and Republicans. And what's really striking is that when we get to the heart of it, they are all in favor of a good many of these reforms. They want to know who's influencing their vote. They want greater transparency. They want to have their voices heard, even if they can't afford to make a $1,000 donation. And I think that's really critical to put in perspective. So I have a few quick questions that I'll bring out and then we can wrap. One, I just wanted to ask you to, I heard yesterday, Representative Greenman, that we have the number of states that currently have AVR, and can you go over that how many that is and what types of states those are? Are they red states? Are they blue states?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Didn't mean to get ahead of myself. And thank you, Representative Bonner, for that question. And I may turn it over to Secretary of State Steve Simon. 23 states have passed same-day registration. Whether my memory is good enough to remember all of them, but I do know that they are red states, blue states, and everything in between. Georgia, Utah, Virginia, Michigan, North Carolina have, and again, because it is a pretty common sense election reform. Let me defer to Secretary Simon if he has anything additional to add to that question.
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Bonner. Yeah, AVR, as it's called, automatic voter registration. I don't know the precise number now, but it's a lot, including the states I think Representative Greenman named. I'll be the first to say, even though I'm a fan and I've testified before this committee before on a standalone bill on that subject, and I think it's the right thing to do, I'll just be honest with you. I think it's misnamed. To call it automatic voter registration makes it sound like it's far more sweeping than it is. It really isn't that sweeping. We already have a system in place right now where we have a motor voter law, for example, where if you go to get or renew your driver's license, you know, you've been there, you take the eye chart test and pose for the picture and all the rest. If you've noticed, there is a box on a form right now that says, check here if you want to be registered to vote. That's right now. All that AVR, as sweeping as it sounds, would do is reverse the presumption, meaning same eye chart test, same photo that you get taken of yourself. But instead of a document with a box that says, check here if you want to be registered, it says, check here if you don't want to be registered. That's it. The back end stuff fundamentally is the same. I mean, there's a fiscal note for this bill because there's some programming and other things that need to be done. But fundamentally, that really is it. So, you know, it's too late now. I think the toothpaste is out of the tube. But this idea of automatic, nothing is automatic about it. It reverses the presumption. The same checks, the same rigor is applied. And let me just say, since I've got the microphone, very briefly, one of the reasons I suspect it has been so bipartisan across the country is it's a real win-win here for people across the political spectrum. What I mean by that is, and I don't want to, I'm not trying to pick at a scab here, I'm just saying, I think we have a vigorous, healthy debate year in and year out about the merits of same-day voter registration. And there's some, probably on this committee, who have concerns about same-day voter registration. People coming in that day when, in their mind, there isn't sufficient time to do the screening and filtering that they believe would maximize integrity. Well, this is the bill for you then. Imagine a situation where a tiny trickle of voters would even ever have to register same day instead of the 300,000, 250,000 that we usually have in every single Minnesota election. That's a lot. That's not a niche boutique kind of service. Hundreds of thousands of people register same day every election. What about a system where that would be virtually obsolete? Unless someone just moved here or there was a really extraordinary circumstance, you'd see almost none of that. Rather, because of daily interactions, whether it's a driver's license or other matters or interactions with state government, people would already be in the system months, maybe even years in advance. They would already have been way in advance of election day, filtered, screened, checked against databases, federal and state. So that's why I assume that it has such bipartisan support across the country. It's a win-win for those who are concerned about same-day voter registration, who have those concerns. This is the proposal for you.
Thank you, Representative or Senate Secretary Simon. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, Mr. Secretary, if I could follow up on that, I'm just curious. Do we have any concept of how much typically states have seen a reduction in same-day registration based on moving to this presumption of voter registration?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonner, thank you. I don't know. That's a really good question. I don't know how many of the states, I would have to go back and look, how many of the states that have adopted it are same-day registration states. I don't know the answer to that. My guess, and it is only a guess, is that it would go down really, really substantially in Minnesota. I would imagine, and this is just a bookmark, I would imagine that we're talking, I could see it being 80% or more, and maybe that's even conservative, of same-day registration would probably go down. Again, that's just a thumbnail sketch. I mean, it would be a massive decrease in same-day registration because people wouldn't need it. They'd already be in the system because 8 months ago they got their driver's license renewed or they had some interaction with government. And there's always an opt-out, obviously. Anyone can say, no, I don't, either then or later, by the way. If someone doesn't pay attention to the form and they find themselves registered to vote and they don't want to be, they can always take their name off. That's current law. So I don't know, Representative Bonner, that's a great question. I guess at this hearing, take a look at that.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Secretary, if I could, I'm just curious also, and I'm not sure if it's reflected in the fiscal note, but my understanding from other states who've actually implemented something like automatic voter registration, that they've seen a substantial cost savings, particularly around some of the forms that have to be filled out for registration, as well as on same day. Obviously, those forms that folks fill out have to be turned into the Secretary of State, and someone has to enter those in the database. And so I've read several items that suggest that there could be a substantial cost savings. I don't know if that's reflected in the fiscal note, but could you briefly speak to that possibility as well?
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bonner, that's right. The states that have implemented so-called automatic voter registration, again, I wince just a little bit because I don't think that's a totally faithful title for this, but we'll go with it because that's what it's become. But I think that, states have said that they do realize savings in the long run. There are, absolutely, you can see in the fiscal note, there are upfront preloaded, front-loaded costs having to do with programming and the like. So in the short term, you're not going to see those. But in the long term, yes, other jurisdictions have pointed out that there are savings. And then there's just the intangible saving that you don't get on a fiscal note, which is hassle factor. And I'm not just talking about for voters, but for administrators, for election judges, for others as well. It makes for a smoother polling place, for example. That's never reflected in a fiscal note. But the states that have done it like it, and I don't know of a state that has gone back on it. In other words, that has adopted it, tried it, hated it, and ditched it. I don't know of one.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Secretary, I appreciate that. My understanding is that it also has significantly helped with lines and timing within the polling places, so making it more efficient. But I guess the last part on this piece that I wanted to circle back to you, Mr. Secretary, is also, I know that we talk a lot about, there's been some conversations even earlier this week about making sure that we're verifying that folks are eligible to vote, that they're able to vote, that they produce the right documentation. My understanding is that using this motor voter form of registration means that we are on the front end verifying all of those items, and that on the back end, that your office is doing a very rigorous set of checks and balances that make sure that folks, that their address is correct, that their name is correct, that there aren't duplicates on the voter roll, that they are in fact eligible to vote, and that there's some sort of notification that they get to validate A, that they are either a voter and where they can vote, or B, that they are not eligible, and remind them of that. Could you maybe walk us through that a little bit?
Secretary Simon, and we want to move along here. We got a growing list of questions. So, Secretary Simon, if you could answer the question, then we'll move on.
Well, I think embedded in the question, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Bonner, embedded in the question is the answer, which is yes. Under state and federal statute, we engage in constant, as I mentioned yesterday, for those who recall, it's pretty much perpetual, daily, a screening, filtering, and checking. So we subscribe to or use or interface with multiple state and federal databases, including death databases, as morbid as that sounds, and they exist at the state and federal level. The Division of Vehicle Service and Department of Public Safety, both for immigration purposes and for criminal record purposes. And so all those checks would continue to exist. This bill wouldn't change that one way or another, but it would give us and folks in the counties and others more time in advance of the election to do that kind of checking. So exactly as you've suggested, that's why I think this is a win-win. I mean, if you're going to have X number of voters, would you like more time or less time to do the filtering and the vetting and the checking? I think we're all on the same page of saying more time. Mistakes can happen. Obviously, they always do, human beings being who they are. But generally speaking, that underlies the soundness of this proposal, whatever you want to call it. Again, it's less sweeping than its title suggests. It really is just reversing a presumption that we already have in Minnesota law. Same form, same process, reversing the presumption. Instead of opt-in, yes, sign me up, check here, it's check here if you don't want to be signed up.
Thank you, Secretary Simon. I might just, so members, so you know, I've got a list here. I've got Mason, Druskowski, Carlson, Quam, Cleavorn, New Brindley, and Kosnick, and Nash. So Representative Mason, if you want to,
Mr.
Representative Bonner, one last question.
If I may just put a pin in it. Thank you for humoring me, Representative Greenman, Mr. Chair, Secretary. I really appreciate that. I just wanted to close with really quickly one item here to kind of underscore this. You know, I think the brilliance of some of the pieces of this plan is that they really do put people and our voters back at the center and at the heart of this issue. But I wanted to briefly read something to you because I think it puts a pin on this. It says here, voter registration issues can be fixed with common sense reforms that conservatives and liberals alike should support. along with a commitment from election administrators to do what is necessary to build confidence in the system at a time when our institutions are under attack. Fortunately, we can vastly reduce the number of provisional ballots by overhauling our registration system to use modern technologies and ensure that name and address information is up to date and as accurate as possible. One way to do this is automatic voter registration, commonly AVR. Automating registration process will create more accurate, up-to-date lists, improve election day operations, and make and recount more efficient in close races. That's from the Secretary of State of Kentucky. And one last piece, with greater accuracy in the rolls, there's less potential for fraud and interference. When our voter rolls are more accurate, our systems are more secure and less susceptible to tampering. It's simply harder to find areas to exploit when the state maintains the most up-to-date list of eligible voters. That is from the Republican representative of Utah, both red, very conservative states. And I guess my point on that here is that, just to circle back and end, thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence, is that this is really about putting people at the center, about making sure that we have secure systems and processes on the front end so that we don't need to use the stick on the back end for folks who might try to violate that. And so with that, I'm going to cede my time, but thank you again for your indulgence.
Representative Mason, and then after that, we have Representative Duskowski. Representative Mason, and if we can move this along and go quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question has to do with the fact that felons or people incarcerated are not allowed to vote. There are some states that do allow it, and because we have people online right now that probably have answers to this, what is the value or history of having people not be able to vote if they're in prison or if they're considered felons?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Mason. And just to clarify what this policy provision does, currently in Minnesota law, you are you lose your right to vote, and you lose your right to vote until not only you finish your time of incarceration, but also until you are finished with probation and parole, which in Minnesota can be lengthy. And so it means that some folks will lose their right to vote. They will be in our communities, working, paying taxes, raising their kids, participating, as we saw, as we heard yesterday from a few of our testifiers, but not able to cast their ballot. And so what this provision does, and it is a, I will not claim, this is a long time provision that has been carried with bipartisan support in both bodies, and that folks have been working on for 10 or more years here in Minnesota and across the country. We're seeing a real movement to it, to ensure that when you are finished with your incarceration, that you then, you're back in the community and then you can cast your ballot. I think that I by no means claim to be the historian on how it ended up in Minnesota, but I will say the history of felony disenfranchisement is deeply rooted in a history of the disenfranchisement of the African American communities of the post Reconstruction period, and so when you look at when many of these pieces were passed, it was around that. But to focus forward, what this provision would do would be to restore the right to vote for those 50,000 some folks who are on probation and parole right now. It also adds, and I think this is really important, and I just want to mention it because I think it's very smart that they added this, and I, again, will not take credit for the really important work that has been done by members of both parties to get this right, is it adds a notice provision for folks so when you are coming out of incarceration that you know you have the right to vote. And this provision is personally important to me. I am a lawyer. I did a lot of pro bono expungements earlier in my career, and I had a client who I was working with on an expungement. She had been quote unquote off papers, so eligible to vote since the 90s, and I was her lawyer in 2012. And she, because she had a lawyer, she asked me, like, can you help me figure it out if I'm eligible to vote? And it was heartbreaking because she had been eligible to vote in Minnesota since the 90s, but she just didn't know because there's so much confusion around the rules. We heard that yesterday. I think one of our testifiers, I think it was Glenn Brown, said it was hard to, and right now we don't have any standard notice. So those two pieces of this, I think, are really important are really important in thinking about how folks have second chances and how people participate in our community. And so I'm very grateful for the work that's been done, and I'm very, very grateful to include it in this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Mason.
Well, the reason I asked about the value is at this point, I believe taking away the right to vote is excessive. I mean, incarcerating somebody is huge. But the taking away their right to vote, as I said, I don't know if it serves any good purpose. And what might be helpful is if they are incarcerated, we should be giving them courses in civics, in government, et cetera, and maybe have them take a test when they leave the facility. But other than that, I mean, it doesn't serve any public purpose to take away their right to vote. That was the point I was trying to get at. So I appreciate what the bill does. I mean, that needs to be done.
But thank you, Representative. Thank you, Representative Mason.
That's the point.
Representative Druskowski, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Looking at the bill and looking at the authors of the bill, it looks like there's 33 all Democrat authors, not a single Republican. It's House File 9. It's one of the Democrat majority's first 10 bills. So it's fair to say that this is the Democrats' priorities for the future of elections in Minnesota. Now, I don't think, Mr. Chair, this anything in here has a chance of passing but into law. But certainly it reflects the priorities. I have a question for Secretary of State Simon. He talked about us having the cleanest voter lists in the country, they seem to be very, very clean. I had a voter contact me after the election and share with me the fact that her and her husband received their two adult daughters' ballots in the mail in a mail-in only precinct in northern Minnesota, and neither of the two daughters had lived with them for 5 years. And so the ballots are still sitting on their kitchen table. She forwarded me photocopies of each of the ballot envelopes and the ballots themselves, and they are ballots, absentee ballots in their entirety. So if we have a voter, Secretary Simon, who was honest, they didn't do anything with these two ballots. So my question to you, Mr. Secretary, is if these two parent voters had not been honest, could they have easily cheated and sent those ballots in?
Secretary Simon.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Druskowski, thanks for the question. And we periodically would get anecdotal reports like this, and in 100% of the cases that I'm aware of, there was a mistake, and the person thought that what was sent to them was a ballot, and it was really an absentee ballot application. We got a lot of calls, and people would say, oh, I thought this was a ballot. But I'll take you at your word that your constituents or people that you talked about at your word that they got ballots. No, it would be hard to do that. And the reason is that typically in Minnesota, when someone gets a ballot, when a ballot like that is mailed to a home, it's because it's linked with someone's personal identifying information. It could be the last four digits of a social. It could be a driver's license number, et cetera. And so it has to be two things have to happen. The ballot has to be returned with that information. And if it doesn't match, it will not be counted. And it has to be returned with the signature of that voter. Let's not forget that. We always have a signature requirement for those who send in their ballots by mail or who vote absentee in person. So we have a couple of different backstops there. So I would say no, it would be very hard for any ballots like the ones you're describing to count.
So Mr. Chair.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you. So Secretary of State Simon, I've got the ballots and their envelopes on my phone, and I'd be glad to show them to you. I'm 100% sure they are real absentee ballots. And these two gals haven't been in that house for 5 years. Now, I know there are people in Minnesota that sign their ballot with an X. And, you know, I don't know what happens with ballot signature requirements. We've got drop boxes that appear around the state. They could have easily been dropped in with the three ballot limit or with the accelerated unlimited approach that was brought forward by you and Democracy Docket, the National Democrat Organization, and the past state political director for Amy Klobuchar sitting in a robe in front of a courtroom. We could have, they could have simply brought as many absentee ballots as they wanted. So I have problems with this, and we need to bring it to be more difficult to cheat, not easier to cheat. And when somebody cheats, it disenfranchises other, whether it's Liban Mohammed with 300 votes in one day, or whether it's somebody in northern Minnesota who may not, or southern Minnesota or central Minnesota who may not be honest like these people were. They kept the ballots on the table and, you know, post-election. But Secretary of State Simon, I don't see how these ballots could, with a less than honest person, could not have been put into the mail, either forging the signature or whatever. I don't know what controls we have in place to make certain that doesn't happen. Can you tell us when an envelope comes in, does the absentee ballot board examine the signature to make sure it's theirs?
Representative Dzikowski, if you could forward those to Secretary Simon so we can do that, check into that. But Secretary Simon, if you want to answer the question.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dzikowski. You know, a couple of things. Yes, the absentee ballot boards always scrutinize for the things I mentioned, the two levels, not one. We're one of the few states, I think it's a handful or fewer than a handful, that have the two levels. We have the signature and we have personal identifying information. And keep in mind, it sounds like you mentioned, I think, Representative Dzikowski, that these are people who live in mail-only jurisdictions. That, too, is not a niche or boutique service. We now have over 200,000, I think it's something like 220,000 voters in the state that live in townships or very small cities of 400 or fewer registered voters that have chosen, their local governments have chosen this option. So they have chosen the option to say that every registered voter in that jurisdiction who lives in that jurisdiction will automatically get a ballot mailed to them. That's their choice of their local small city, very small city, or township. So yes, the absentee ballot boards must go through that. We also have relationships, and all counties do, and our office does, with the Postal Service as well. So if there's a postal issue and the person isn't supposed to live there or they're moved, you know, that's supposed to be reflected in whether or not they're the resident of that district. But we have a very good record in Minnesota. The percentage is not even worthy of a percentage. The speck, I would say, of voters who are caught up in any sort of misconduct is absolutely vanishingly small. One election recently, it was 18. We have 5.5 million people in the state. One election, it was 22 or 23. Again, we have millions of people voting. So I just want to put this in proper perspective. One other thing, Mr. Chair, if I can, I want to use this opportunity to correct the record on just a factual matter. We can all disagree on policy. That's a healthy, normal thing. But I do need to push back on just a factual error. Representative Dzikowski, you and others have persisted in one factual, I would argue many factual errors, but that's a different discussion. You mentioned the so-called ballot harvesting lawsuit. That was one. In other words, we have a three-person limit in Minnesota on the number of other people's ballots that you can return. So if you're going to the courthouse, you can say to your spouse and your two neighbors, hey, I'm heading that way. I can take your ballots in as well, but you can't do a fourth. You can do your own and three others. And that provision was challenged in a lawsuit that we defended and are continuing to defend. So that has been conflated with and smooshed together with other lawsuits. But let me set the record straight here. We, our office and the Attorney General's office, always and without interruption have defended that statute, and we won. As you know, for a few weeks there this summer, because of a district court ruling in St. Paul, that state law was struck down. We then took it to the Supreme Court and won. So I'd appreciate it if in the future, and it's okay for you to criticize and have a different view from me, but please rectify the factual error that in that particular instance, that was part of a consent decree. That issue was not. We continue to defend that law, and we did so successfully, reinstating that law to the Minnesota Supreme Court. And finally, let me say another thing, given the climate that we face nationally as well. And again, Representative Drazkowski, I'm not trying to muzzle you, not trying to cancel you. You were entitled to your opinions, and you're a principled person. I served with you. It's not what I'm trying to do. But when you impugn the integrity of a judge and name names, and others have named this judge's name at rallies and insinuated that they're going to go to her house, any judge, liberal or conservative, based on their past political association, I think you're playing a really dangerous game, one that could lead to violence, could lead to worse. But in general, I think it's poor form to assume that because of someone's past political association, they're going to rule a certain way. And it goes beyond this particular judge, who some people on this committee may know, may not know, but there are people of both political parties in high places in the judiciary that have had past political associations. And I would never for a minute, impugn their integrity, and nor should you, nor should anyone else, and assume that they're in the pocket of a political party that reflects their past association. We have a justice on the Minnesota Supreme Court. I hasten to add this only because it's someone I deeply respect, who used to be general counsel for the Republican Party. And he is as honest as the day is long. He is ethical, he is smart, he is honest, and he would recoil in horror at the suggestion, I'm sure, I'm not speaking for him, that his past association with the Republican Party would make him biased in any way. And he is not, in my observation. And so I just want to warn us against those really simple, maybe crowd-pleasing insinuations about judges' past political associations.
Thank you, before we go to Representative Drazkowski, before we go, just remember, we have to be out of here at 10. We are going to vote on this bill going out. So testifiers, if you could keep your answers short, and if we can keep our questions short, it would make it easier for me to get to the rest of the people on the list. But we will be voting on this before, and if we have 20 people on the list, we will still be voting on this today. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for properly identifying the Simon filibuster.
There's been some on both sides.
I had to bring a little levity here. So Mr. Secretary, I'll be glad to discuss that with you further, and we should probably meet sometime, but I definitely still have, as many Minnesotans do, not only the appearance but the content of what happened last summer collectively, have some very, very substantive issues with our state laws and our constitutions. Members, we want to make it less probable that people are going to cheat in elections. This bill seems to go the other direction. Additionally, we're seeing in this bill a problematic thing that happen, and we've seen it happen with Section 12.31, which we've been discussing for about a year. We've seen it happen in other places in election law and other places where the legislature has delegated its authority and responsibility under the Constitution to the executive branch and or judicial branch. Now, in this case, we've got on page 13.1 another such delegation. And I just have a question for the author, Mr. Chair. Why would we delegate legislative responsibility in setting the rules to the executive branch?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Drazkowski. And what we're talking about is the 13.1 other agencies and units of government. Is that just, I want to clarify, because I want to clarify, because I'm not exactly sure what your question is getting at. What this provision does is say when agencies have verification of citizenship as part of their processes, that they can come online and be an automatic voter registration agency. And so we don't want to add, we want to make sure agencies have all the information they need before that they're part of this program, to make sure that they have all the information about eligibility, about citizenship. So we make sure that only folks who are eligible to vote are sent on to the secretary's office. But so that is why this provision is in here, Mr. Drazkowski, or Representative Drazkowski, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Greenman. I will read that again and closer, but it appears to me that we are giving latitude to the executive branch to determine which documents they are going to use to accept for voter registration. So if that indeed is the case, I've got a problem with us delegating, just giving to the executive branch the ability to determine rules and things that are going to be used around election law, rather than prescribing to them what they should use as we normally do. Mr. Chair, another question I have is around
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, is around absentee ballot drop boxes, 24.27, page 24, line 27. So I have to turn to there, but we're expanding the ability, I believe, for more drop boxes to happen in Minnesota. I know that some there were a bunch of these this last election that happened. I don't know if it was legal or not for the units of government to put these absentee ballot drop boxes out there, but many of them were unstaffed. And so the question I would have, I guess, is for the Secretary of State. If we are going to propagate more absentee ballot drop boxes and have them unstaffed like we did the last election, how will we and how did we ensure that people weren't ballot harvesting when they were dumping absentee ballots into these? Apparently, I understand, and maybe the Secretary could give us a direction on how that works. There's supposed to be documentation when somebody harvests up to three ballots in our state, in which they prove that they have authority from the people whose ballots those are to actually carry them and deliver them to the proper place. We didn't have that in Minnesota in many cases in the last election, and this bill seems to expand the ability for that conflict to happen. So I'm curious if the Secretary could comment.
And Representative Greenman, do you want to take a swing at that and then the Secretary of State or Representative Greenman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Drazkowski. I just also wanted to clarify, and I am looking forward to as you dig into this, I would love to connect with you. Just to be clear, Section Subdivision 5, 13.31 does not change any of the requirements on the eligibility to vote or what the Secretary of State's office needs. What the only thing it is saying is making sure that an agency has the information required to send it on to be able to go through that process. So I just wanted to, and I am looking forward to digging in more with you, but I just wanted to clarify.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Greenman. Secretary Simon.
Thank you. Well, actually, Representative Drazkowski, in a way, we're on the same page here, believe it or not. I think you've identified something, as has Representative Greenman, which we need to tackle. I should say you need to tackle. I don't have a vote, which is resolving the ambiguity in state law. And I put it this way, and I'm not trying to filibuster, honestly. I'm just trying to answer your question. Right now, the sum and substance of Minnesota law says, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, hey, drop boxes can exist. That's basically it. I'm summarizing, of course, without a lot of meat on the bones. You know, does it have to be made of a certain material? Does it have to have cameras? What is the security or chain of custody requirements or all the rest? It's pretty silent. And so given the rush of people who wanted to vote absentee this time and the counties and cities' desire to use these for their own administrative purposes, they turned to us, I don't blame them, and said, what should we do? We wanted there's demand for this out there. What should we do? State law is pretty much silent. It says, yeah, you can have drop boxes, but doesn't tell us, you know, time, place, manner, anything else. So we did our best because there was no legal guidance. We surveyed all the states and we said, well, we can't tell you what the law says, say much, but we can tell you what some of the best practices are from states that have had these for a long, long time. And that's what we did. And I'm happy to provide the committee, if you wish, with our list of guidance. I think we did that during the summer as well, send it out to key legislators, chairs and ranking members. I believe we did. But anyway, we were left with, well, all right, here's our best guess, not as to what the law is, but what it should be. So you are right, Representative Drazkowski, that the law, whether you like them or not, drop boxes, if we're going to have them, let's at least have some meat on the bones. We don't want to micromanage in terms of, you know, type of metal or all the rest. But like other states have, I think we should have some meat on the bones there and have at least some floors, not ceilings, about what is required. You have properly identified an issue that we grappled with, frankly, which is given the three-person limit, which, again, we successfully did all the way to the Supreme Court once it was reimposed, given that, you know, what do you do given the absence of language in statute? And we determined that our guidance was to counties that that optimally they should staff every single drop box. That's just not a possibility we realize in every place given resources and staff, but optimally you would have a human being there. If you can't do that, you need strong signage. Again, we're working with what we have here. We can't create law out of thin air. Signage that says, hey, stop. Do not use this if you're dropping off anyone other than your own ballot. To do that, you need to talk to a human at the desk or at the courthouse or whatever. And there is a logging requirement. And those logs are kept. We have those. We don't have them, but the counties have them. But you have properly identified, Representative Drazkowski, an area where if we're going to have drop boxes, let's at least, you know, you don't want to nanny the thing or micromanage the thing. Let's at least put some standards in state law.
And Representative Drazkowski, one more question, and then I will have to move on. The list is continuing to grow, and we're running short on time. And I know Representative Nash wants to wrap up, and I know Representative Greenman needs to be able to wrap up her bill.
Thank you, Chair. Well, just to thank you, Mr. Chair. So just a follow up to the Secretary. So the other part of that, and thank you, Mr. Secretary, is that we have a law, and maybe you can review that with us, that says that we have to actually check the authority of ballot harvesters to deposit or carry and deposit their ballots into wherever, whether it's at the county auditor's office or wherever it is. So can you verify for us that this law was not enforced at those locations where we had those ballot boxes in the last election?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, to the contrary, we know of no absence of enforcement. I mean, counties really wanted to do the right thing. They treaded very carefully. They really, and I don't think our counsel is on the call, B.B. Black, but she received numerous, as did our elections director, like, are we doing this? We don't want to overstep our bounds. I'm paraphrasing here, obviously. We don't know. I mean, counties were really conscientious. I don't care where they were in the state. Like, can we do this? We don't want to get out ahead of our skis. What do we need to do to ensure that this logging requirement is followed? So I don't know of an instance where they didn't faithfully execute the law. I mean, maybe you do, but I don't. And I can just tell you, certainly anecdotally, from constant contact with the counties, this was an issue they took extremely seriously, not wanting to do more than the state law allows, not wanting to let any cracks in the system appear. There was some real anxiety about this issue out there, given, of course, the huge surge in demand for absentee voting. It became a bigger issue. That's why it was much more of an issue this year than in other years. And just for the record, I mean, we had 58% of voters this year vote either from home or absentee in some form. Only 42% did the traditional thing, which is show up on game day, on election day. So that's why it became a bigger issue this year. That's the best answer I can give.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just one quick comment.
Representative Drazkowski, quick comment.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. So, Mr. Secretary, my point was this. We had ballot drop boxes around the state. I know of dozens of them that were unstaffed. If they're unstaffed, there can't be somebody there checking to see whether the logging requirements in law for the deposit of absentee ballots happened. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Secretary Simon, I got Representative Carlson and then Representative Quam. Representative Carlson, quickly.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I promise this will be just one question. And to provide a bit of context around some of the line of question we received so far, perhaps the bill author, Representative Greenman, if you could talk just in bullet points, briefly describe, and if you you know, if there are other items to be added to the list of these things, please reach out to your testifiers as well. But can you talk about how your bill empowers voters? What is this doing to empower voters across the state of Minnesota and add the transparency and voter confidence that their vote is going to be correctly counted? Can you just highlight in just some real quick statements what this bill does to that effect? Thank you.
Representative Greenman and bullet points, not a dissertation. We're running short of time here. You don't want to filibuster your own bill.
Bullet points are great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Carlson. I don't think I'm filibustering, but I could talk about democracy all day. So I'm glad we had this extra hour and a half to hear the bill, and I really appreciate the question, and I think it allows me to just draw out some of the things we've already talked about. So when we think about how does this bill and how do these provisions, the voting provisions, the campaign finance provisions, the redistricting provisions, put Minnesotans at the end of the day at the center of it, one big way is with the democracy coupons, we are making every eligible 3.3 million registered voters in Minnesota now have the access to two $25 coupons to invest in and participate with the candidate of their choice, Democrat, Republican, Independent, marijuana party, or no party at all. That is a big piece. It also gives voters information. We talked a bit about the disclosure. I think Representative Bonner talked about that. And I know this committee has heard disclosure before, but it gives voters information about who are the big donors and who are frankly the dark money, the money that's trying to influence all of our votes, but we just don't know who's spending that money. And then the last thing I will say, just to be really quick, is another key piece that we haven't really talked much about is the redistricting provisions that really allow voters, Minnesotans, communities, input. They allow folks to be able to see the proposed maps and give input, and all of us have to have a fair set of criteria that we're redistricting. So that is my very short answer. I hope that was short enough for you, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate the question.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, looking at the dollars in here, I'm disappointed that it's authorizing the state to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to bail out politicians. I think we've got other places that we could spend that on, and that's stretching out. Too many people are fixated on the last election, and what I'd like to bring up is we've got a history of looking into, and I gave the chair and the legislative auditor, committee administrator, the legislative auditor's report link on voter registration, also the Social Security Administration HAVA link on verification, where I gained the information that I spoke on yesterday on the other bill. But in House committees, we had testimony, and there were thousands in the 2016 and 2018, actually tens of thousands, that were bad registrations when verified by the federal HAVA site for Social Security Administration. In fact, out of the report and the committee, there were more than 26,000 individuals whose status was marked challenged who voted in the November 2016 election. And frankly, that is why, if we look over the history of the state where statewide elections have been decided by a few hundred votes, it's important that our citizens realize that when we do election bills, we ensure verification and integrity. And I'm not seeing that in this bill. And frankly, I'm concerned because if you're not connected, you're not rich, you don't get the lawyers to be able to get probation, some of the non-incarceration penalties. And so this bill would make that even worse for the poor, the unconnected, because they're sitting in jail and can't vote, but the rich can get probation home monitoring, et cetera, or get out with a light sentence and the probation, and they get to vote. So if we're going to address the issue, we should address the issue that doesn't further disenfranchise, discriminate against the poor and the unconnected. So, you know, the dollars, the need for, you know, verification, and not making a situation that some people are very concerned about worse, I think the author really needs to address some details. And I hope that the committee members will look at what was done in the past and understand some of the issues that have been brought up on elections based off of government documentation from our own legislative auditor and the federal HAVA site. If the author could have some reassurances that she's going to work on this. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Greenman, and after that, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Quam. And I share your concern about the disparate and the disproportionate impact of our criminal justice system on poor folks, on folks of color. I started my career as a public defender, and so if that is something that we could work on together, I would really, because I agree, we need to create a justice system that works for everybody, and we should, the right to vote shouldn't be caught up in that. I do want to correct. On the fiscal note, and I'm not sure, maybe you were talking about going way out. This fiscal note is, right now it's at $36 million, which, as I said, for a biennium is a good and not, is a small investment in our democracy. So I just wanted to make sure to, focus on that fiscal note. And then on the question you raised about, the audits, I'm wondering if I could, phone a friend and ask Secretary of State Simon if he has any additional comments on that.
Secretary Simon, quickly on the audits.
Yeah. I just want to make sure I have a question. You're talking about the Office of Legislative Auditor, that audit, or the post-election? I just don't understand what you're asking me to comment on.
Representative Greenman.
I actually, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam, if you could clarify that, the sort of got a little off in the middle of the question, but when you said the you were talking about audits and votes, and so if I got that wrong, we can move on.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We all have to look at the tails, you know, about the dollar thing, but the audits do include the, you know, follow-up after confirmation of validity of addresses where, you know, thousands in just Ramsey County in one election. So it's more inclusive, and there actually was an audit and a follow-up audit. And I can offline make sure that the committee members get the materials I was looking at. Thank you.
We can do that offline then. I'm going to go to Representative Nash if you want to wrap up, then we're going to give that Representative Greenman wrap up her bill, and then we're going to vote on this. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'll just say this. Many of you, well, all of us have received a public subsidy, unless you choose to not abide by the spending limits. And as I read this bill, and as I've looked into it, this could put way more money into a campaign than, say, the amount that we get. I think I got like $3,800. This could blow way past that, way, way past that. That's concerning. But I want to point out for folks watching and for the folks in committee, two things. One, elections bills have had a long time history of being bipartisan. This is not that. This is bananas. And I've spoken with the chair about my concerns on this. I've spoken with the author about my concerns on this. This doesn't have any bipartisan support. We will not put up one vote for this. It is, as others have said, it is welfare for politicians. This has a fiscal implication of almost 200 and something million dollars over 10 years to pay politicians to this is craziness. And lastly, Mr. Chair, I think there has been a rush to get this out of committee. Many on my side have questions still. I think that on a bill like this, that there should have been some consideration to make it perhaps multi-day. I mean, many of these issues were their own committee hearing, and it took up a couple of committee hearings. I mean, felon voting, when Representative Dean had it, took up more than one day. There's so much in here that is, in my opinion, outrageous, super hyper-partisan. The spending is out of hand. The fiscal note that Representative Greenman just referenced actually isn't done. So her assessment of the fiscal note is not accurate. It's going to be much larger. So I would say, Mr. Chair, it's certainly your committee, but I think that this is not a bill that is even ripe to move out of committee. So with that, I urge my members to vote no.
Representative Greenman, if you want to wrap up and then renew your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash. And I am grateful that we got a chance to talk about the bill. And I would just start by saying that these are actually not partisan issues. It's not about what Democrats or Republicans here in the legislature want and need. It's actually about what Minnesotans are asking for. And all of these reforms have been adopted in red states and blue states by Democrats and Republicans. So I would, you know, love to have you as a co-author on the bill. I realize that's not going to happen. But just to that point of, I think we're at a point where what Minnesotans are asking for across the state is to really be at the center of our democracy. And so when we think about the voting rights policies, the campaign finance policies, it really is about giving voters the power of transparency, of up to $50 to be able to support folks in their community who are running for office, and of having access to the ballot and being able to participate. I'm going to close with something we heard. You know, we have had another hour and a half of testimony after a good hour yesterday. So I am really grateful for the 2.5 hours we've been able to spend on this bill, and also would note that a few of the bigger provisions will also have standalone bills. We could talk about this. I'd be into talking about each of these pieces.
Quickly.
Glenn Brown said in his testimony yesterday, democracy is very important. Of course, we're going to have all different points of view, but we're living on this earth and we're all here for a reason. So I'd ask you to vote yes support this democracy bill. I will renew my motion to refer House File 9 as amended to the Committee on the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law.
Representative Green renews her motion that House File 9 be referred to as amended to the Committee on Judicial Finance and Law. The assistant will take the roll. Chair Nelson votes yes. I didn't hear you.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Yes.
Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Bonner.
Yes.
Representative Drazkowski.
No.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Cleburne.
Aye.
Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick, no.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative New Brindley.
No.
Representative Pulowski.
Pulowski, aye.
Representative Quam.
No.
I didn't miss anyone, did I?
Did anyone who wanted to vote not get counted?
With 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails.
Thank you. The bill's on to judiciary. And members, I apologize to those who had their name on the list. I still had 5 more people on the list, but we ran out of time. And with that, members, we are adjourned for today. Thank you.